I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. When Dr. Martin Luther King was in Milwaukee, actually he was here several times, but on January 27th, 1964, he was at the Milwaukee Theater, and he said, "We have argued and discussed civil rights enough, and we must not get bogged down in the paralysis of analysis. This problem will not work itself out. Somebody must be dedicated. Somebody must be willing to stand up. There is a need for a sort of divine discontent." On this day, we honor the life of Dr. Martin Luther King. Two who have stood up are with us in our Milwaukee studios. We have a whole lot to talk about. Milwaukee, the worst in the nation for black-white residential segregation, worst based on poverty, the worst incarceration rate for black men, the lowest percentage of Hispanic-owned businesses, the widest gap in the nation in black-white test scores, the widest black-white employment gap in the country, and a growing gap in life expectancy between black and white Americans. We have two guests with us in our studios here in Milwaukee. Reverend Steve Jerby is the pastor of a multi-ethnic, mostly African-American congregation in Milwaukee's Harambee neighborhood, All People's Lutheran Church. He has been calling for police accountability and federal investigation into police shootings of unarmed black men, and he has been very much involved in several cases here in Milwaukee. You'll recall Darius Simmons, the 13-year-old who was fatally shot by a neighbor who thought that Darius had stolen his handguns. Darius was a member of Reverend Jerby's congregation. We thank you very much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Broken ankle and all.
That's right.
He's scooting in, and we thank you so much. Also joining us, he's been here before, is Kwabena Antoine Nixon. He is a man of many talents, a poet and educator, and event organizer, host of Poetry Unplugged. He has co-produced all kinds of incredible programs, Kings to Thugs to Presidents. He's president of the Milwaukee Urban Entertainment Alliance, the Don't Promote, I Vote campaign. I don't just promote, I vote. He's co-founder of Flood the Hood with Dreams, co-facilitator of the conflict resolution training seminars. He has done some incredible work with teenagers in Milwaukee public schools, Saving Our Sons, I Will Not Die Young campaign. And Kwabena, thank you so much for being with us and for all of your poetry.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well, let's start by talking about Dr. Martin Luther King, who actually was a fairly radical guy in many ways. I sometimes think that we kind of sugarcoat what he had to say. He gave his life for all kinds of good things in this country, many of which need to be realized. But I'm just wondering how you've taken what he said, let's start with you, Reverend, into your heart and into your ministry.
Yeah, well, everybody can recite lines from I Have a Dream, and many students have had the opportunity to read Letter from a Birmingham Jail, but the depth and scope of the work of Brother Martin cannot be underestimated. He was engaged in the work of civil rights and racial justice, but he also was able to connect the dots around economic justice and the violence that poverty brings in the midst of that. And also, he was able to connect the dots between the dogs of Bull Connor and the fire hoses and the conflict in Vietnam, and that just as a police state is violent against people of color in this country, the country was resolving conflict through war overseas. And we see that, unfortunately, continuing. What inspires me in my work is that Dr. King had deep theology and was probably the greatest theologian our nation has ever produced. And one of the texts that I've really been focusing on this year is a speech he gave saying Guidelines for a Constructive Church, where he preached on the passage where Jesus goes into the synagogue and reads from the scroll of Isaiah, "The Spirit of the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor, release to the captive, liberation to those who are bound, sight to the blind, and to declare this is the year of the Lord's favor." And that's the call of the church. and he was calling the church to be engaged in the work of justice. And if the church isn't good news for the poor, then it's not good news. And in a congregation rooted in one of the poorest economic neighborhoods of Milwaukee, we have to take seriously the struggle of poverty, but also identify the incredible gifts among folks who are living in poverty, and not to see those neighborhoods as having nothing to offer, nothing mm-hmm. to give, but mm-hmm. really the heart of the work that is already going on.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about what's been really hard about this particular year. Not that it's not been with us for some time, but when you think about Dr. King entering the world of 2015 and 2016, the whole loss of faith, the increased loss of faith in the justice system in this country, the number of young black males who have been killed by police, the uproar that's taken place, the demonstrations that have taken place all over the country. This has been a very, very hard year, Kwabena.
Oh, yeah, without a question. I mean, you know, you say it's a hard year, but if I go back, it's been a hard time since I can remember, being 13 years old. I remember how 11 years old, I was about 13 years old coming from school. In the neighborhood I grew up on, the west side, it was, you know, pretty gang heavy.
Chicago,
west side of Chicago, was pretty gang heavy. And I'm not saying that we were angels or innocent, but I remember as a boy running because somebody said it was a fight that broke out. You know, we running, getting away from the fight, and the police, I never forget how they pulled up and pistols loaded, on my friend's, right at his dome, head. I mean, if he sneezes, he's shot. You know, and for what? We were running, you know? So it's been unrest. It's been going on. But I think it's at a point now that there's this energy, this bottled up energy, and you really don't know what to do with it with some of the young people. So it's to a point where they're saying, I'm not taking it anymore. They don't know what to do or how to do, but they know why they need to. And it's been a hard year because a lot of times they're asking young people to calm down, right? Oh, be cool. But nobody's asking the police to calm down. You know, it's not the other way around. It's not young people shooting police. It's a police shooting young people or black men of color. The legislation is saying, the politics and the powers that be are saying, calm down. But they're not checking themselves to calm down. So right now you cannot, you can't put it all in the bottle and shake it up and expect it not to begin to come out mm-hmm. like that, right? Mm-hmm. So that's where I think it is right now. A lot of people are upset, frustrated, and angry. And if I think about what going back to what you asked, if anything that he inspires me is this conviction that this is what I have to do. You know, it's no, and his urgency and his message, if you listen, and not you because you were there, but most of us, if we listen now, we say, when he says, if not now, when? When I listen to Dr. King, I think of urgency. I think of a man of saying we have to do something because he knows there are only so many days of his life left. He's very, as Pastor Steve said, one of the most profound ministers of our time because of the usage of his words. He took time to say the right words at the right time because of the urgency of what his life.
So. Yeah. Yeah. I just began the hour by talking about a whole host of Milwaukee having the first in all kinds of things that aren't very good, segregation, the number of African-American men who are in prison, the gap in the country when it comes to black-white test scores, the employment gap in the country. Can you address, both of you, why it is that all of this is happening in Milwaukee, and what are the forces that keep us from moving to the bottom of this list?
How much time do we have?
Right. We have an hour. Pastor Steve, what do you say?
Well, I think the heart of all of this is that white supremacy is still entrenched in the way that this nation moves. And more folks are starting to talk about white privilege and the fact that conditions in the United States are not equal. And that because I am white, because I am a man, because I am straight, the opportunities that are open to me are far greater than others. But privilege doesn't go far enough to speak to really what I would call the demonic forces of white supremacy, that when we look at all of these disparities, we have to ask ourselves, who benefits from this? And benefits in multiple ways, but often follow the dollars. Who's getting paid off of a failing educational system? Because in a capitalist structure, somebody's always profiting. Who's getting paid off the mass incarceration of African Americans? And until we start to dismantle these systems of oppression, then we aren't going to see the kind of outcomes that Latinos, African Americans, the queer community, all of these oppressed communities are entitled to, and are part of, you know, what our nation lifts up as the creed of what we live into. And yet the American dream has been a nightmare for so many for so long. Mm.
And Quabbin, I put this in the context of Milwaukee. Why is it Milwaukee is number one on all of these lists?
Well, again, it goes back to what Pastor Steve says, as I can bring it home. It goes, you know, Amiri Baraka, the great poet, Amiri Baraka, better known as Leroy Jones, he said, if you ever want to find the truth, follow the money. Isn't it funny, in a city like Milwaukee, or a state of Wisconsin, that upper Wisconsin, where there's little opportunity, most farming communities, wide space, get to vote on if they want a prison in their area, that you literally have people celebrating, like, we want, making a proposal to get a prison in their area. Now, is that to say that they want a prison in that area because they want to better the people that they're putting in prison, or they want jobs in that area? Now, I know we all need to have a job, but your job should never be off the failure of other people. I can't see people celebrating and clapping for a prison to come to your community to lock other people up, to separate people from their families. If that's the culture of the, if that's the mind state of the, if that's the mind state, then that trickles all the way down back into the city. You say, why is it Milwaukee? Well, if we look at, I've been here since 96. If you look at the cycle and the practices that have been here in Milwaukee, the welfare system, if I'm correct, it almost took care of the north side of Milwaukee. Everything was based on being paid on the 1st and the 15th of the month. The school system, this was at a time factories, like most cities, but that's definitely here industrial. So you went to school to learn your trade, right? You went to school to eventually take a job at the major factories. Well, once that ended, now what do you do? And last but not least, if we really, really look at it as Pastor Steve, and I'm going back to what he said, who makes money off the failure? And if you're a betting man, if you're a person that says, where do I invest my money? Would you invest in the success of the city, or would you invest in the failure? And right now, if you look around, the failure is what would bring you money. So who wants to stop money when money is coming in? And I think Milwaukee is the best place for it with the powers that be, because its practice has worked. The practice has can. What we see now in the school system, what we see now in politics, what we see now in funding and all those things, we see the result of years and years and decades of neglect. And we've seen people look the other way, and now it's in your face. Do you understand what I mean? In the city of Milwaukee, it's so small that, you know, they say in certain areas, they say, crime is not going to stay contained in this area, because criminals can only rob criminals after so. There's only so many criminals you can rob. There's only so many other people you can hurt. Now you have to. It goes out past the border. It's like once upon a time, quote unquote, the powers that be said, "Well, the drugs are in the city. That's their problem." But piece by piece, it passed the borders. It got out, and people came in. So, I think some of it is by design. Don't want to say the conspiracy theory of some power that be is sitting over the top, but I do say that people make money off the failure of others. And in this place, the practices have showed that neglecting, not paying attention, and paying and letting things fail is profitable for those who are looking for a prophet. Mm. So
let's talk about how what both of you have outlined have affected the lives, particularly of young African-American males in this city. Darius Simmons was a member of your congregation. I know that you became very involved with helping the family through the funeral and through the criminal justice proceedings. I know that you have done some phenomenal work, Kwabena, with young African males who have been victims of violence in their families and who you've done mock funerals for these, mm-hmm. and they've vowed to change their lives. I don't think many people have a sense, if they're not in that community, of how all of this is affecting families. And if you would be personal about this for a moment, the young, particularly African-Americans you've worked with, Darius Simmons' family, Dontre Hamilton's family, and how in many cases they have had enough, and now they're speaking about all of these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. In Milwaukee, we have our equivalent of just about every national story, mm-hmm. you know, Derek Williams being our own victim of I Can't Breathe, mm-hmm. and Dontre being our own Mike Brown, and Darius Simmons really our own Trayvon Martin, where he's killed by a white vigilante. Darius and his older brothers were actively involved in the congregation. They worked in the community garden and lived just a few blocks from the church. And Patricia, his mom, said, I need to get my family into a safer neighborhood. I mean, that's the irony, that she believed leaving the neighborhood would be safer for her boys, moved to the south side, and in a mostly Latino neighborhood, it was one white neighbor, elderly man, who couldn't handle a black family moving in next door. Mm-hmm. And because of all the negative images that surround blackness, it played into all of his fears. And we'll never know what was behind his heart there. But, 13-year-old boy in middle school. And imagine the students who show up to school and see his desk empty. Mm-hmm. Imagine showing up to worship on a Sunday morning and to know one of our own is lost. And that was a profound moment for me, because Darius was the first victim of gun violence that I knew personally, but I was really had this epiphany that for my community, he wasn't even close to the first. Mm. And that as I sat with mothers, and my congregation has a list of Gold Star mothers who have lost their sons to gun violence. One of our deacons who lost a son 25 years ago to gun violence, and another mother who just a few months later in a drug deal that went wrong, lost her son. So this violence is a constant and is a reality, and it skews young folks, because mm-hmm. they imagine that being 11, 12, 15 is middle-aged, because they can't imagine mm-hmm. a reality living through their 20s. And unfortunately, that has played out too often in the lives of their friends. It's heartbreaking. And so as a community of faith, and as a place that really invests in young people and in young adults, the greatest thing we can do is restore hope and say that a plan and a purpose is greater than this, and to lift up examples of folks who have risen above the circumstances of violence.
We'll ask Kwabena the same question in also welcome your phone calls, too. We're honoring the life of Dr. Martin Luther King this hour. Milwaukee has substantial problems when it comes to segregation, when it comes to violence, when it comes to a lost dream for many, particularly minority males in this community. And we're talking about why that is the case. We're looking at Dr. King's dream and welcoming your phone calls as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Dr. King is worth listening to always, but on this day I always listen to several of his speeches and just listen to some of the quotes, too. I think this kind of frames why we're talking about this today. He said, our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter. And certainly these issues matter. To you and to more of our conversation in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're honoring Dr. Martin Luther King this hour, and I would like to, we're going to take phone calls in just one moment at 800-486-8655. Kwabena, you've done some incredible work, very moving work, powerful work with African-American males who have had violence in their families, including mock funerals. I'm wondering how your approach has been effective, and I know it has, and why, and you are one of them. You lost your dad to gun violence. How you approach this issue of guns in the African-American community, of violence, and of allowing people to have their own dreams, how live those own their own dreams.
Well, thank you again for having me, and I thank you for the conversation. I just want to commend Pastor Steve for the work you do in the community. You're very outspoken on your beliefs, and you stand for something, you know. And I just wanted to tell you that I've always seen you stand for things, and you've said things that pastors, African-American pastors, and I can say that have not said in the community. So I thank you for standing for that. And I started off with that just to piggyback as I answer the question that it has to become personal. It has to be personal. I do the work because it's personal. Just because I was one of them, you know, I know what it is to be a young black male, as Pastor Steve said, middle age. I'm only 46, and the young men will literally touch to see if I'm alive, you know?
Oh, like, no. Yeah, you look very young.
Yeah, I'm 46, and they'll say, you old, you know? But, you know, it's funny, when I was their age, I thought that was old because that was a reality that there's a chance that you're going to die young. I mean, we're at a point now where me and some of my friends and I say, I really don't know what to do now because I didn't really prepare to be this age. All right? And that's the truth. That was a reality you dealt with, that there was a good chance that either from the police or the people you are dealing with of your own race, there's a chance that you may die young. It's just a part of that. With that being said, when I go back to the community and do the work that we do, I take it personal. I feel like I got out, so I have to go back and pull somebody out. And I want to show them tangible ways, like, look, this is how it's done. It can be done. A young child, a young black child in the neighborhood needs to have a dream. They have to have some form of fashion. That's what keeps you alive. That gives you your purpose and your destiny, as Dr. King said. And we try to give them, to show them that they would. There's a Dr. King in them, meaning that he was a young boy like them. You know, Barack Obama, our president, did not see his father till he was almost 9 years old, right? He was the product of a single parent, right? So we want to show them, like, look, it's very, very possible that you come from these circumstances that you can get out. And the harder the circumstances, the more resilient you are. And people in our communities are very resilient. African-American people are very resilient in those communities because they'll make a way out of no way. And what do I see when we deal with it? It's very traumatic. I mean, let's be honest. If you say they call Chicago Chirac, right, and they call it Murder Milwaukee. Well, let's just say a 10-year-old hears someone get shot that night, right? Now, the effect of it is crazy, just the whole aftermath, that the body lays out there for so many hours, literally. They can't go move the body. So everybody is kind of watching this, talking about it. It's almost like you become numb to it because it's a regular thing. Tomorrow you walk outside and go, wow, he got shot here, and that's where this is. And then there's a group of mothers who almost share the same story. Like, I lost my son at 18, I lost my son, right? And then when you go to school as a kid, you sit in class and you say, yeah, what's the name? I got shot last night. And we go back to work. And then the teacher, if they're not sensitive to the issue, says something to the nature, well, you know, things happen, we got to move forward, right? And everybody in the community, politicians included, and other people will say, look, life is hard, but you got to move forward, right? So here you are, 10 years old, you just saw the most traumatic anything. If you were another race, they would call you Anne Frank for your resiliency. But because you're not, you're a troubled kid, and the expectation is this is too hard, you won't learn, and you're in trouble. So you're going to carry this. That's trauma for the rest of your life that nobody addresses. So what we try to do when we do the classes is we give them a lot of cathartic writing. We give them a platform to just say, here's my truth. This is what happened to me. This is how I feel. This is how messed up I believe it is. And then after that, now we're going to put something back in. The mock funeral is just basically where we take a group of young men who are on the verge, one foot in and one foot out. They can go either way. And they have this grandiose picture of what it looks like. I'm going to die, and it's going to be thousands of people around me, and they're going to write my name on the wall. And it's, you know, it's nowhere near that way because the media shows the worst of who they are. And we let them walk up to a casket, look in there, there's a mirror, and they get to see, this is what it looks like. It's going to be people at your funeral. Your mother's going to be crying, dressed in black. They're not going to talk about you when this is done. You're just going to be another black boy dead. That's the reality we have to show. So which one do you want? Do you want a long life of abundance and triumph, or do you want to die quick and young? And last but not least, why is it that way? Ms. Kathleen, I believe this. The worst thing you can do is show a people that they are half human. And media has a way. If you live outside of the African-American community, Latino community, if you live outside of those areas, by the time you get through watching the news, you will think they are all beasts, they are all animals, and they are all murderers.
Yes.
So when you're a police officer, or you just, I'll give you better, there's a group of young men in African American, and I'll wrap it up. There's a group of young men in African American community who call themselves, they say they come from the zoo, the Burleigh Zoo, right? Just to, you know, the name, right? So what is a zoo? A zoo houses animals. And what do animals do when they can't find food? They hunt and kill each other. They become predators. And nobody bothers the animals as long as they're killing each other. But the minute the animal goes past its boundaries, what do you do to an animal? You shoot it, you cage it, and you put it away. And what did he say when he saw Mike Brown? I saw a beast in his eyes. And no one cares when you kill the beast. No one cares when you incarcerate the beast. We have to change the whole conversation, the whole image, and we have to hold media accountable for the images they portray, whether in, that they say these are true images. No, this is a subculture that they've helped promote and say this is what it looks like. That's not what it looks like. So a campaign we're creating is called This Is What It Looks Like, to show positive images of African-American males and females. This is what it looks like. Anytime we do something positive, young men with their fathers, young men with their daughters, whichever one, we want to show the image. This is what
good,
it looks like.
Good. And the mock funeral, can we put that on our Facebook page? Let's do that. You should see it. It's dramatic. And what's hopeful about it is you've got these guys who kind of have their heads down. They want to listen to you. And by the end, they're locking arms. And they've talked about the things that are written about, things that are important to them and the dreams they have. And you get the feeling that they're, you know, a little step further to doing something that at the end. It's incredible.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655. Earl in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Earl.
Hi. I just wanted to mention, a lot of times I have a dream speech as mentioned, but I really enjoy his All Here Now speech. One of the things he mentions is violence is the language of the unheard. And I just wonder what your guests think about these days, the Black Lives Matter, you know, right or wrong. You know, people when they don't get heard, you know, things like this happen, which not to say they have points and stuff, not to say it's fine violence. I don't think he meant that, because he for sure preached peace. Like you said, I'm glad Jesus said to love my enemy, because if he said like, it'd be hard to like my enemy when they're bombing my house, when they're hurting my children. But he said love them. You know, it's just his all here and now speech was, it's about a half hour from beginning to end. It's really good.
Thank you, Earl, for the call. Pastor Jerby.
Well, Black Lives Matter as a movement across this country is multifaceted. There's so many dimensions to it. And here, one of the strongest expressions is through the Hamilton family and the Coalition for Justice. And anytime you hear Maria Hamilton, his mother, or Nate Hamilton, or Damian Hamilton, any of them speak, they come back to this message of one love, that really the Black Lives Matter movement here in Milwaukee is rooted in love, a love of blackness, a love of the community, a love of Dontre, and a love of activists and supporters who come together to say, Milwaukee can be different. We don't have to look like other cities. We don't have to look like the worst outcomes for African Americans in the country. But we need to respond in love. And that love doesn't mean that we back down. That love doesn't mean that we shy away from speaking the hard truths. And that love doesn't mean that we can tolerate business as usual. And so disruptions, marches, protests, all of that, while there's an energy and an anger at the injustice, behind it is a powerful message of love, love of self, love of community, and a hopeful future.
Mm. And if I can add, you know, with the Black Lives Matter, if I'm right, sure. You're speaking on, I'm so for it, but here's my fear of it. What happens when that's not the new catchphrase of the day? There's so many catchphrases, and now Black Lives Matter, it's almost like it's been co-opted. Like a Black Lives, it's the end thing. You know, like I'm down with the Black Lives Matter, and it's no offense to Pastor Steve and the others I know they're doing, but one of the things we've been really stressing is tell that to each other. In my community, I'm constantly telling young men, look, I don't need you to go shout to them that Black Lives Matter to the mainstream media. I need you to know that your lives matter, because our lives matter. One way or the other, when this is over, when they decide that there's no more Obama's brother's keeper and no more of that, and the money is pulled from certain things, will people still say Black life should matter one way or the other? So if we have to shout it, yes, but we have to restore. Murder happens because there's a lack of pride. It's not a lack of resources. It's a lack of pride in our community. We don't have that same pride that we have, and so we have to go out our way to instill that pride and tell each other, look, our lives matter to each other. Mothers should not bury their children. You know, brothers should not die young. That should not be the norm. So, good brothers, we need to change it. So that's why we're fighting Black Lives Matter, but I really want us to understand that when this catch, and I hate to belittle it by saying a catchphrase, I'm just saying the rooms I've sat in, that's how it's thrown out. Oh, you know, it's the Black Lives Matter. And you say, well, they've been mattering for some time, you know, so.
Point well taken. Let's go to Jake next. Thanks, Earl, for your call. Jake in Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon, Kathleen. I wanted to comment on something your guests were talking about earlier about who benefits from the failure of Milwaukee and that, those sorts of things. And he was talking about white men, white privilege and white males in particular. In my opinion, who benefits from the failure of all of this is corporate government run by corporate ministers, like the U.S. Supreme Court with its Citizens United decision, like the Congress, corporate Congress, and you can go on and on and on. And it's we have corporate government, and Wall Street and the corporate world is who benefits from all this failure.
Reverend Jerby.
I don't disagree. And when we look deeper at who runs the corporations that are profiting off of this, the number of CEOs, it tends to be white men. And to that point, it is those that are in power will do all that they can to retain power. And so we have to look at how long of a legacy have folks been in power, and it just morphs into to different expressions. And so now it's the power of the corporation, which in a globalized economy, you know, is more powerful than governments in a lot of ways.
Thanks for the call, Jake. Let's go to Jonathan in Fox River Valley. Hi, Jonathan.
Good afternoon. Happy holiday. 2 points. The first one is it took us a long time to get to this point. Things are not going to be solved in the time it takes to order a pizza or download a movie. We need to be in for the long haul on this. The second point is, until minority communities put people in elected offices, positions of power, nothing is going to change. We can march, wring our hands, all we want, but until we get elected officials making decisions for minority communities, things will remain the same. Thank you for the program. Have a grateful day.
Thank you, Jonathan, for the call.
If I can, you know, first off, I think we've all been in for the long haul. I mean, I think we've been in it for the long haul. As we spoke when we first came in, and I asked you about where you were when it happened with Dr. King, and you, in the first time I ever heard someone say, well, you know, by that time, this had been the third or fourth assassination, right? So you've been in it for the long haul. We've all been in it for the long haul since 1619, the first time African Americans were brought over here during slavery. And I'm not belittling its comment, but I just want to say it. And last but not least, I think the worst thing, and this is just me talking, I can't speak for anybody else, is the worst thing we can ever believe is that an elected official will change our community. It does not come from that. It comes from the people. Yes, there are laws that need to be passed. There's certain legislation, but Dr. King did not come from the political form. He came from the religious form and the movement form. Any great leader that has been in our time did not come from it doesn't come from the power. Yes, there's the Barack Obama is in office, right? There was Harold Washington in Chicago, but all of them came from the people. The people pushed that agenda. An elected official is, let's be honest, that's their job. Let's just be honest. That's an elected official. Sometimes that's their job. Their job is to do what they have to do. They're politicians. So there's going to be a time they're going to make a deal. But people don't make deals. People deal with every day what's going on in your community. Your handshakes, who you have to look in the eye. It's more personal. Sometimes with elected officials, it's not personal. In Milwaukee, especially in the city of Milwaukee, when you say, do in our black communities, in Latino communities, do we have a body of people who can hold them accountable? We have constituents, but is there a caucus of African Americans who say, this is the checklist, and according to this checklist, you have not done XYZ? Because even if we say we vote the mayor out of office because he isn't doing XYZ, so who comes in next that has our best interests at hand? Do you, and not just African American, but the city and all, the city is better when everybody is getting fair share. The city is better when everyone is working and has pride in it. Because we have pride when the Packers play. Everybody is united. When the game goes off, it's back to normal. They'll say the Packers won, but also on 15th Street, this young man was shot and killed. Move on to the next story. You know?
So where does, when you were talking earlier about inspiration and about, you know, this campaign, which is a really worthwhile campaign, who's going to give people the inspiration? Does it come from the neighborhood itself? Does it come from people like Dr. King and from President Obama, who's done something that's a first, who does give people inspiration? I mean, I know he does that, and I know Dr. King still does. But don't we have to go through a process that's established in order to give people the basic necessities, get them out of poverty, get good education, people who inspire us, so we can be inspired? Or is it homegrown somehow? Is it grassroots inspiration?
I like the term you use, process, because everything, this is just how I process things. It's a marketing campaign. And when I say marketing, meaning the evil people and the men who want no, or the people who don't want to see things flourish, they'll promote their agenda. They'll put it out consistently, daily. They'll let it be seen. It's on television. It's in the media. It's on the news. It's always, it shows the worst of. So what do you say about how do we inspire people? We have to look create a conscious campaign of inspiration in the same way. They need models of inspiration. They need to see images of people who got out and made it out. One of the things I love doing is going back, and we brought 35 men with shirt and ties into a school. The young man had never seen anything like that. He said, the only time I see black men in suits is if they go into court or they go into a funeral. He had never seen it. But once we got done talking, once he saw these men, heard these men share their stories and women share their stories of, yes, I went through the same things. That's one. Show them images. Another thing after we show images and modeling is, like you have church on Sunday, you have to have those same things in the community. You have to have outings, poetry readings, public excitement. It has to be, inspiration needs to be loud. I believe ignorance is loud right now. The new conversation is violence and death, right? That's the conversation. We have to change the conversation. So you have to have inspiration, you have to have modeling, and last but not least, make a movement out of it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of ignorance in this country right now. Pastor Steve, how do you inspire people?
Well, I think the inspiration is all around us. And yeah, we do look at those giants in our history, and we need to know their stories, and we need to know civil rights leaders beyond the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And we need to know abolitionists and freedom fighters in that legacy. But my inspiration comes from Mr. and Mrs. Kane, who are elders in the community, who tell the stories about how their sons have not only grown up through MPS, but have achieved amazing success. We see it when the black fraternities are doing service and investment in the community. We hear it from the artists. We need to look to the artists. And Quabana is an amazing, inspirational mm-hmm. presence in this city, not only because he can spit amazing words, but because he's here and he's been here for the long time and he's invested and he's accessible, you know. Mm-hmm. Obama's not accessible. We can't get there. But you can call up Quabana and have a cup of coffee with him.
Yes, sir. You added coffee makes you black.
Let's go to another phone call. Thanks, Jonathan, for the call. Lori in Viroqua. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. I would like to bring up the institutions that we use to justify racism. My example of the day is Charles Murray, 20 years ago, wrote this horrid book called The Bell Curve, saying that, you know, basically black people are just dumber than the rest, than white people. And he was discredited at the time, but yet he works for, I don't know, I guess the Enterprise Sisters Institute right now, and he's still mm-hmm. quoted on the radio as some sort of expert. 20 years ago, they destroyed the cash assistance program, AFDC, which, you know, it had problems, but for the most part, it was successful in supporting families. They destroyed that, telling children that it's more important for their mothers to be out doing some low-wage job than to taking care of them, and that's the generation of young people that we're seeing right now growing up, and they're going after the education system again. It's the same people. It's yes, please, that's my comment. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Quabana.
I think what she said, that the same people are in the bell curve and those things, but again, I go back to what I said about the ignorance is loud, then freedom has to be even louder. I just worked with a group of teachers, social workers, counselors, at a school that I'll be working at. And the question they asked was, like, how do we prepare ourselves to deal with the young men? Majority of them were Caucasian. I said that I named several books that they had. Had you read these books? And they said no. I said, well, if you're going to work with the population, then you should understand and know the population, not just by the fact of, like, what we need to get out of power, but let's look at the power that's already here. Juwanza Kanjufu wrote a great book called Counting the Conspiracy to Destroy Black Boys, Volume 1 and 2. In that, he gives tangible realities about tangible, he gives great tangible things that we can do to combat ignorance like the bell curve, you know, because I think everybody writes based on their perspective and based on the finances they'll get, you know, and who they come across, who they've come across. So maybe that person that wrote the bell curve, that's what he, that was his experience. But we don't have to take that word as law. Of course, he would work, you know, in that institution. It is an institution. Like, I close with this. It's funny. And it's not funny, but I call it a dark funny how in some crazy way, when we were in middle school, we were quite, quote unquote, kind of being prepared for the prison system quietly. You know, like, you know, the windows have kind of bars on them, right? You have little physical activity, right? Kind of you're wearing a uniform sometimes, right? You eat lunch, you walk in a line, you know, you take, you know, you understand what I mean? Quietly. Like the conversation me and my friends and I had in high school, and we were getting ready to go to high school. Now, a young male on the other side of town is probably saying, I'm going to play basketball, I may play baseball, I may play football. Here we are in the mid-80s in Chicago. This is a friend of ours on the porch. If we go to this school, we're going to have to link up with this gang. Because, you know, if we don't link up with them, and if we're going to go this way, we got to go through so-and-so. And when we get there, you know, you might have to fight so-and-so. We're not worried about the peer group. We're not worried about the pop, you know, being popular. We're literally having a conversation quietly as a kept about our lives, right? So you being, you know what I mean? That's what you're being prepared for. Right. So you just have to combat it with education and research that you to make yourself better when you're dealing with the population that you're going to be working with.
I want to talk about segregation, and we'll do that in just a moment and take more phone calls as well. We are honoring the life of Dr. Martin Luther King on this day that we honor him. His birthday is actually January 15th. Would have been 83 years old. Still, you know, not that old a man. He still could have been contributing to society, but of course he was assassinated at the age of 39. We're looking at a whole host of issues, but this America that we face so many years after he left us, and a special emphasis on Milwaukee, which has topped the list for things that we shouldn't be very proud of. More phone calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Time for one more phone call, probably. Harry in Madison, hi.
Hi, thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you, Harry.
There's a lot of talk about lots of different things, a lot of cliches. So here's the bottom line. Education. If our people don't get education, this problem will never be solved. We must teach our young people to love education. In spite of all the discrimination and the poverty, you can still get a good education in this country. And people have a choice to make. They can choose life or they can choose death. I'm from a poor black family. My mother taught me to read before I went to school. I was literate before I went to school. And we need to teach the mothers to read, and we need to teach the fathers to stand up and fight for the community. That's all I have to say.
Thank you so much for your call. Pastor Steve.
Clearly, education is at the heart of transformation, but we need to have educational systems that support our students. Mm. And when we divest resources, when we divest energy, when we see teachers fleeing from the occupation, when we see an assault on education, then it really does fall back on the family, the community, the faith communities, faith leaders to invest in that education, because we can't just expect that putting our kid on the bus is going to be enough to bring about change. That education doesn't just happen between school bells. And so we need to be educating all of us around not just what it takes to succeed, but also how to form a beloved community. You know, white parents need to be educating their children about the racism that exists, and not shy away from that hard conversation. And communities of color need to continue the educating work that they do in their homes.
Does it bother you? We have about 30 seconds left. That we are so segregated.
Yes and no. It really, yes and no. When you say education, you need to know what you look like. you need to see images of who you are. When you walk into school, it is a great thing to see someone who looks like you for your first understanding of who you are. I can't teach my grandson about Christopher Columbus without talking about the kings of Africa. I can't teach him about let's bring it together. So it's bad because it's separated, but there's some things we can build on. And as he said, the beloved community is acknowledging who you are.
Thank you both so much for being with us on this day. We thank Reverend Steve Jerby. He is the pastor of multi-ethnic, mostly African-American congregation in Milwaukee's Harambee neighborhood, All People's Lutheran Church. And we also thank Kwabena Antoine Nixon, poet, educator, event organizer. Go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show.